Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again, this time on the near side, for another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. It's amazing. But everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. And his laws are unchangeable. They serve as an infallible guide to meet every crisis, every change in life. If we can rise sufficiently out of the rut into which any situation or circumstance has pushed us and apply the same basic laws to our particular situation as preceding generations have used, we'll find the same result. God's laws never change. Everything in this world changes except God's basic laws. For example, as a man thinketh, so is he. An understanding heart is the most precious of earthly possessions. Man is master of his mind, and hence master of all circumstances. These laws have always been basic. They're just as true now as 2,000 years ago, or even 5,000 years ago. God never abandons us, even though, as the 23rd Psalm so clearly assures us, we may walk in the valley of death. He provides the strength he knows is necessary for us whenever we need it. Such are fundamental laws which apply to every situation, terrifying or not. Everything in life has a purpose. We may wonder sometimes what purpose some misfortune can have, but every event has its role in the growth of the human soul. Sometimes the purpose is not revealed for years, or if we fail to exert the strength God gave us, perhaps is never known to us during our passage on earth. But nevertheless, everything that happens to each of us has its share in the growth of our soul. No matter how unpleasant any situation may appear, how far removed at first sight from any seeming possibility for good, this fact remains. What happens to each of us is part of the Creator's divine plan, and how we react is the privilege which God has given us. The way we react represents the freedom extended to each of us by God. No intelligent human can fail to take hope, watching the intricate mechanism of life, with each minute's experience fitting perfectly into the overall life pattern. A bee buzzes as her path crosses a little too closely our own. A bird chirps a cheery call to its mate. A spider spins its web. These phenomena, in fact, everything in life, have their particular reasons. When it rains in our lives, it is because we need the rain in order to enjoy the sunshine and reap rich harvests. The way we meet all these phenomena, the way we master life, is our liberty of choice, mercifully granted by the Creator. The effect of every cause depends upon our reaction. Our soul grows as we overcome the trials and appreciate life's beauties and happy interludes. Oh yes, we can give vent to hatred and intolerance or despair, or we can deny these emotions which blind us to love and beauty and truth. And then we may acquire understanding instead of always seeking to have others understand us. No man can antedate his experience or guess what faculty or feeling a new object shall unlock, any more than he can draw today the face of a person he shall see tomorrow for the first time. So wrote Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it's true, we're constantly learning new lessons. Often we find that what we have learned is that which we have failed to appreciate and to understand. Maturity often comes too late for us to profit by the lessons we should have learned earlier, but never too late for each of us to try to pass on to those who follow the lessons we finally understand. Life is a process of continual change and development as well as growth. But God's laws are never changing. To be happy, to make our lives satisfying, we must be flexible enough in mind and body and consciousness to accept changes when they come. Don't stubbornly resist all changes in your life and affairs. Make these changes yield the harvest of good that potentially lies in each one of us. This may be difficult, but let me tell you, you can do it if you will. You, as a matter of fact, and only you, can determine whether you are to be bowed down, crushed, steamrollered by the events of life, or overcome them and come out triumphant, a happy individual. That's your right if you apply God's basic laws. No matter how drastic changes in your life may seem, in your occupation, your place, or mode of living, in your surrounding or associations or activities, or anything that concerns you, good is in this change for you. If you search hard enough to find it and accept it and make it your own by your reaction, by your adaptation to this change, scenes and times and circumstances all come and go. But God is eternal and unchanging, and so is his law. His good is unfailing. What each of us needs is the deep personal conviction that this good exists in every circumstance. Then no matter what may come, we can remain poised and serene, free from fear. When we are aware of and exercise the tremendous power of our minds to dominate circumstances overcome obstacles and snags. A peaceful, contented, and satisfying life is within our grasp. You know, actually, we're really not alive, except when fighting the perils that threaten the mind and soul. Life is a challenge, a wonderful challenge, a wonderful adventure. When there is no struggle, life degenerates into vegetable-like existence, inert, torpid, and decadent. It is the challenge of peril, physical, mental, or spiritual, that makes life vigorous and can make it triumphant. There are inevitable moments of our lives when a storm is as certain and as necessary as storms in the skies. There are other moments in which life's elements combine to give us a serene, perfect moment, when sun and temperature make the day electrically beautiful. We cannot prevent these extreme highs and lows that temper our soul, make them grow. We can only do our best and never relax our faith in God's mercy. Whatever experiences we meet on life's course, in order for our minds and souls to attain maximum growth, we must always hold firmly in mind life's basic analysis. And what is this? Well, life is composed of two parts. Keep this always in mind. Life is composed of two parts. The first part, beyond our individual control. Events, circumstances, situations, problems. The second part, the part we can control, our reaction. The experiences we cannot control in no way prevent or limit our choice of reaction to these same experiences. Thus, in the end, our reactions, the second part of life, is much more important than any experience or situation or problem. Imagine an ocean dotted with coral islands, some small and some large, and washed by rising and outgoing tides. There you see a graphic illustration of our lives. The islands are the experiences we cannot avoid, the situations which sweep us away with joy or with sorrow, with happiness or anxiety. Before any man's life story is fully written, he must move from many of these coral islands to others. We cannot choose our individual islands of experience, but like the tide that flows against them, we can roll triumphantly over the coral rock, or we can break in many pieces. The way we move from one island of experience to another is ours to choose. Destiny provides the experiences we meet. We exert our own reactions. Do we wonder why life appears difficult at times? Do we wonder why there exists such reckless disregard for God's laws? Do we wonder why what seems evil appears to rage rampant in the world? We need not and should not be disheartened. There is no living thing in the world, plant or tree, fish or fowl, protoplasm or human being, without a place, a particular place, in the Creator's perfect plan. It is not necessary for each big or little entity endowed with life to be conscious of its own mission. It is sufficient to know there is no life, no spark of life without a purpose, no death without its role in the drama of life. Study the physical body. The answers to life's spiritual and intellectual cycles are clearly shown each day for our enlightenment. The body's marvels show how clearly sorrow and joy, pain and pleasure transform into part of a picture of growth. We begin our life in strife and struggle as we are born, and these conflicts continue until physical death. So sometimes you may feel that your load in life is too heavy for you to carry, that it is weightier than your strength and endurance can bear. Readjust your thinking. The strange thing about your load is it doesn't really bear down on your shoulders. It actually lifts you upwards. Imagine a load which lifts you upward. The life without a load is a life that goes down in defeat. Hear the fable of the small boy who read the story of Atlas, the titan who carried the world on his shoulders. The little boy imagined at first that Atlas must have been almost crushed under the weight of the world. But later, the youngster began to think in terms of Atlas's enormous strength. Only then did he begin to see that heavy loads must be wings that lift instead of crushing burdens. The small boy perhaps did not realize it, but growth was taking place within him. Soon the conscious physical reaction of the boy to his thought processes had him lifting the biggest stones he could find and carry. He tugged at paving stones and heavy wooden blocks, simply to pit his strength against them. And just like the boy, as we go through life, we learn no one can be really happy unless he carries a load. A human being fully lives only as he lifts. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC. Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities? Many problems? Many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes he may pick up a load too heavy, may get him down, may fall on top of it, but he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose. Despair, the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage an ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting and gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heart's desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendously effective to us. Our whole life is changed. Yes. The way to grow toward the light is like When Nature Wants a Man by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will. When she tries with all her skill and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him. How she goads, never spares him. How she whets him and frets him. And in poverty begets him. How she often disappoints. Whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path. Puts a bitter choice before him. Climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind. Could we understand her mind? Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks. When his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says, watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude.
That bitch good, nigga.
Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurt himself.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out.
This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-Civil Rights Movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
All right, today's topic is titled, Don't Kill Your Golden Goose. Don't Kill Your Golden Goose. And essentially, we're going to be talking about self-induced, what I call self-induced gentrification or self-induced genocide, particularly in the African-American community. Black community, whatever you want to call it, here in the United States. Let me read some statistics to you. Well, not statistics, but, they're partially statistics. The top 20 most gentrified areas in the United States where black folks on a critical mass basis, their children and grandchildren can no longer afford to live there. Let's see, should I read from the top to the bottom or from the bottom to the top? I'll go from the bottom to the top. And this is a list of 20. Mind you, as I've stated several times this week, and I'll probably bring up this stat several more times in the future, that there are 19,500 municipalities in the United States. Okay, the 20 most gentrified cities in the United States, coming in at number 20, we're going to go from number 20 on up to number 1. Dallas, Texas, coming in at number 19. Detroit, coming in at, and what's in, you know what, What's interesting about Detroit is, last time I've been through there, and this is back in the 90s, that Arabs, not black people, Arabs dominate the convenience store ownership market. They call them party stores in Detroit. And the gas stations, and I guess much of the auto mechanic business there. And that's a town that, hey, Democratic, Coleman Young was mayor for 20 years. Home of Motown, till they moved. Coming in at number 19, Detroit, Michigan. Coming in at number 18, Philadelphia. Coming in at number 17, and these are major hubs, population hubs for black folk here in the United States. Coming in at number 17, Chicago, Illinois. Coming in at number 16, Baltimore, Maryland. Coming in at number, and that's crazy, but, you know, Baltimore's got like over 55,000 vacant buildings. Anyway, coming in at number 15, Los Angeles, California. Coming in at number 14, San Diego, California. Coming in at number 13, and this is the town that triggered me to schedule this podcast in for this morning, the original podcast that I had already up and loaded up for today. I moved it to tomorrow. We'll be talking about the Cupcake Millionaire. And I think she gives a gentrification solution on a one-on-one basis. But anyway, number 13, Washington, D.C. Used to be 70% black in the 70s and 80s. Now it's down to 46% black and shrinking. Number 12, Indianapolis. Number 11, Minneapolis. Number 10, Sacramento, California. Number 9, Phoenix, Arizona. Number 8, San Jose, California. Number 7, which is the largest country, or excuse me, largest city in the United States, with the largest metro area in the United States, New York City. It's the seventh most gentrified city in the United States. Number 6, Austin, Texas. Number 5, New Orleans, Louisiana. Number 4, Miami, Fort Lauderdale. Number 3, Boston, Massachusetts. Number 2, Denver, Colorado. Number 7, the San Francisco, Oakland Bay area. Well, those two cities in particular, not area, but those two specific cities, city propers in particular. One of the reasons why, and I'm telling you how they're getting them out. Two primary weapons, well, maybe three. And this is in no particular order. Code enforcement, high property tax bills, and that might be the number one trigger. No. Let's not order it. And the third thing, lack, and this is probably the number one thing. I'll put this at number one. Lack of estate planning. When you bring those kids home from the hospital, that's when estate planning starts. Now, granted, they're not old enough to digest anything, you know, when you bring them home from the hospital. But, you know, kids learn, we all learn by, you know, watching our parents do things. And I think, you know what, as early as first or even kindergarten, start introducing your children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren to estate planning. So by the time they're 15, if anything happens, they can take over with a seamless transition. Generational wealth. We're going to do a regular series on this because I have some new next-door neighbors in my D.C. house. And here's the backstory on it. The parent who got that house, along with her husband, and with no high school diploma when they purchased that house, is 101 years old now, but in a nursing home. They put the house on the market, and the house sold within a week for over $500,000. Now, two of the children, it's a brother and sister that was in charge of everything, of course, they received $500,000, probably more than that. And I very seriously doubt that not one penny of that $500,000-plus will be within that family within the next 36 to 60 months. The siblings that were in charge of everything, just two of them, to have grandchildren and probably great-grandchildren by now. I know the matriarch at 101, she's definitely got great-grand. When they sold that house for $500,000, they effectively killed the goose that laid the generational wealth golden eggs. Their children, grandchildren, and great-grands will effectively have to start from ground zero. What took this family over 65 years to build was wiped out within a week. Not because of any natural disaster, not because of any war, not because of any white person or white supremacy or whatever you want to call it. It was self-induced genocide. You may as well call it familial suicide. Grandkids, great-grandkids, they killed the goose that laid the generational wealth egg. And it's rampant. Oh, and by the way, they sold it to some Asians who owns some nail salons. And the customer base of the Asians who bought the house for $500,000 plus in cash, their customer base is black folks, primarily. And that house will probably be within that frame for the next, guaranteed the next 100 years. Guaranteed. So this little example of that, you know, how did the population, how did D.C. go from Chocolate City? How is Detroit going from Chocolate City? All the 20 cities that I just named and more, that's how it's being done. Self-induced genocide, self-induced gentrification, that's what I call it. There's some strategies for that. My whole thing is this. You don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. That house could not only house another generation or two, because it's a three-level house of people in the same bloodline. But there's another unit there with a separate entrance, has its own bathroom, has its own full kitchen, and laundry room. Three generations, 2 to 3 generations could still live in that house with privacy, but they wouldn't have to worry about paying rent or mortgage payment. And none of those kids or grandkids or great-grands can afford to move into that neighborhood. Or they couldn't even afford to buy the house that was sold. 619-768-2945. If you got any strategies, my strategy is this. Whether you have a family or not, a basic estate strategy, at least in my mind, is this. Breed, and this is from the Amish community, start a business, and that business will be your golden goose. Tomorrow we're going to do a whole bit on a lady that, and I've mentioned her on here before, that started with $5 and turned it into $10 million. Flipping cupcakes. But, and the reality of it is, we talk about, you know, black-on-black crime, but the biggest eliminator, or maybe not eliminator, well, eliminating them out of the housing game, which is more prolific than any of these shootings that go on out here, be it black-on-white or black-on-black or whatever, is probably for every one shooting, there's 5 to 10 black households that are voluntarily impoverishing their blood relatives. My strategy, or a strategy that I suggest, develop a golden goose in your family, but don't stop at one. And my definition of a golden goose, how does that define that? It's got to be some type of income-producing asset. some type of income-producing asset. And then take that, what the Amish, for instance, let's use the Amish community or the Mennonite. The Amish dad has a furniture building business, a furniture making business, excuse me. That is, and he builds furniture and he sells it. That's his golden egg for the family. He raises his kids and teaches them how to build. Now, they can be rocket scientists if they want to, but fundamentally, this goes right behind potty training. Right behind potty training is learning how to operate the family business and start subsidiary businesses of the family business or businesses. Right behind potty training. Amish or Mennonite mom, she's good at baking shoe flower pies, you know, dinner rolls, different pastries. Like, see, tomorrow we're going to feature a black woman who took $5 and turned it into $10 million with cupcakes. She was fucking flipping. She still does cupcakes. That way you don't depend on just one goose. You've got yourself a gaggle of geese that are all laying golden eggs as much as you want them to, every day if you want. A lot of the problems in the black community, from my point of view, not all, come from we are killing our golden goose that lays the golden egg. One of the takeaways from this particular family, they only had one golden goose. That was it. Just one. You need to have a gaggle of them. And that way, if family members want to get together, and you know what, I need an extra $500,000 that we can split. You get it from your other geese that are laying golden eggs. You don't sell them, but you have more than one. You have geese, a flock of geese that are laying golden, and you get your $500,000, $1 million, or $2 million that way. Put on the audio, but it's not doing what I want it to do. Okay, let's try something else.
Let's keep switching the identity.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They want to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Thank you. apparently today I'm giving a book review about Behind the Scenes by Elizabeth Keckley. Now, I know what you're going to say. I've given you this disclaimer 17 times, unless you haven't watched any of the videos, which I don't blame you if you haven't, but I'm going to have to give it again. I know that racism doesn't affect me, and it has never affected any member of my family, aside possibly from the Native American that could or could not be there, depending on how reliable my family records are. Anyway, I have not personally dealt with or known anybody in my immediate family that has personally dealt with racism, so I can only speak from the opinion of an outsider. So I cannot speak on the issues at hand, I can only speak about the work itself. So, now that that's out of the way, moving on. Oh, second part to disclaimer. This is a literal nonfiction account of what happened. It's only kind of novelized into, it's something more readable than straight up record keeping. Disclaimer's over. Now onto the actual substance of the book. And I mean, there's possibly some interference from whatever person was editing the book before it was published. And I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to take it as it is. I'm going to give Ms. Keckley the benefit of the doubt in saying that she had more authority over this than most, because there are some fairly incriminating things. So I'm just going to go ahead and go with it. Now, the story actually starts out about 30-something years before she actually got to the White House, and it starts talking about her as a slave. She starts talking about her experiences and how terrible, but unfortunately and sickeningly not abnormal, this kind of a life was at that time. She eventually gets a husband. She eventually decides to leave that husband, and he decides to leave her because he's not doing anything. She's paying all the bills. She's working and all this stuff. She's doing all the things. And she is doing really well in the seamstress business. She's making a lot of dresses for a lot of fairly important people at this time. She eventually makes her way up to getting into the White House, which, oh my word, that's freaking amazing. And she is my hero from now on in eternity. When she actually gets in there, she gets to be very good friends with Mary Todd Lincoln and Mr. Lincoln as well, to a lesser extent, because Mr. Lincoln is preoccupied all the time with political squabbles and this and that. And even that is not necessarily the main point of the book itself. The main point of the book itself is to portray what actually happened in the scandal that happened after Mr. Lincoln's death surrounding Mary Todd Lincoln. And the fact of the matter is that Mary Todd Lincoln ran herself into so much debt with all of these dresses and all of this stuff. It would not have been a good day if Mr. Lincoln had found out. She's basically just documenting the events that took place after everything was discovered and after Miss Lincoln had to sell off most of her collection of dresses and gowns to random people, to auctioneers and whatnot. Now on to some critical analysis. As I said, I can't criticize actual events, so I'm just going to criticize the way that it's written, sentence structure, and the like. And as I said, this could have possibly, and in fact, it is fairly likely that it was influenced by some white male publisher or something of that nature. But I am choosing to give Miss Elizabeth Keckley the benefit of the doubt and saying that she had a majority of the authority on this particular work. And if she hasn't, and if you know for the fact that she hasn't, please let me know down below. But I'm going to leave that at where it is. The sentence structure is beautiful. It reads like some wonderful poetry. The descriptions of things are amazing. The analogies are amazing. The similes are wonderful. It makes me cry every time I think about it. If you like reading very beautiful words and very beautiful sentences, then I would definitely recommend this to you because it is wonderful. Specifically for that. Everything is very well thought out. There's no loose ends. There's no loose sentences. There's no thoughts that didn't get completed. Everything is very well put together and very tight and very clean. And it seems to me to be a very good, clean book that I can read now as some 19-year-old who has the attention span of a fly. And I find it very compelling, not only as a story in of itself, but also as a literary work that can be remembered for generations longer than it already has. It's already been 3 or 4 or 5 generations since it's been written. I found it on Barnes & Noble in the clearance aisle, and it is really a nice addition, if I do say so. The cover is very beautiful, and I find that the dust cover is nice, and not only that, but the actual binding is very well done, and it's got this almost cardboard feel on the inside. It's very old-fashioned. It does the book justice, I feel like. And I would highly suggest it to anybody who would want it, even if you don't have this nice edition that I have, that I got for really cheap. Anyway, and it was also another introduction for me to the life of Frederick Douglass, because she talks about Frederick Douglass, she meets him, she talks to Mr. Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln about Frederick Douglass, and when Frederick Douglass was not invited to a particular party with the Lincoln family, she talked to Mr. Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln, and Mr. Lincoln was like, bring him in, I'm a fan of that man's work! Where is he? I want to shake his hand! And you could say that these events were made up to make Abraham Lincoln look better, but I choose to be on the side of optimism and say that these were actually the events that took place that Miss Elizabeth actually put down on paper and recorded for all generations to see later on. And one more thing. I have to remind you that this is the oldest book besides the Bible that I have read, period. And this is definitely the oldest book that I've read this year that is in the form of a novel. And it was published in 1868, if you can find it on the page. And this is one of the first books that I've read that's nearly 150 years old, if not older. And I told you I was going to tell you later what it was, and I forgot to tell you later in the video. So I'm telling you now, this is the book I was talking about. But anyway, on to other things. And I remind you that I said I was only going to be uploading on Thursdays, but I think what's going to be happening is I'm going to definitely upload on Thursdays. But if I have time and I have the resources and I have the energy and all the other stuff, whatnot, I am going to upload on Mondays as well. But if that is going to interfere with anything, if that is something that nobody's really interested in, then let me know. As again, please let me know what you think of these videos. Please let me know how I can improve them. Please let me know if there's anything else you would like me for me to do. The books that I'm reading are the same books that I was reading last time. I'm almost finished with Hollow City, and I am nearly 3/4 away finished with Harry Potter 5. So nothing has changed there. But I suppose that's all I've got to say. So I guess I will see you in the next video with the next book. Goodbye.